комару. Ты душа любезный, совсем не под пару. Ты цветешь, как роза родного Кавказа.
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And you listeners out there who are generous enough to become a patron and send us money every month to let us know how much you like the show and that you're willing to invest in it. If you want to become a patron and join that exclusive club of special people, go to patreon.com/Eurasianknot and hook us up. So, another week, Rusana.
Yes, another week, another struggle.
Yes, like the struggle continues, huh, all the time. Well, it is nice, though. We did get a new sound submission, and we actually have a few sound submissions on deck. So once again, it's going really well.
Yes. I mean, I almost feel like we should stop saying that it's going so well because it makes like our listeners think that like, oh, okay, so it must be that other initiatives like have failed miserably.
or they might think that, hey, maybe we have a lot of submissions and they don't need to bother, right?
No, but you do need to bother, guys. You do need to bother. Keep them coming.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Keep them coming. Send them in. So this submission is from a listener named Ken Bergen. He sent this audio recording from the Czech Republic. So let's listen to that. And Ken says is that this is an announcement sound from the Prague railway stations. And he says that it's actually the opening bars from Bedřich Smetana's tone poem, Má vlast, which means my homeland. And he says that it's a very famous piece of Czech symphonic music. He's not sure how long it's been in use, but he's been going to Prague since 1977. He's been there about seven times, and it's been around since then. So clearly, it's been a long time.
Very consistent.
Yeah, very consistent.
So, Sean, what are your thoughts on this sound?
Well, I was thinking, you know, these opening bars, it kind of reminds me of how if you listen carefully in some spaces, you find these national sounds, right? The fact that this comes from a poem mm-hmm. called My Homeland, and other cultural sounds kind of embedded in everyday life where you wouldn't expect them. And I find that really interesting that this is, instead of just a meaningless tone for the arrival of a train, let's say, they have something that's really connected to Czech history, Czech culture, and Czech national identity.
Yeah, that's a very clever observation. Maybe someone should write a master's thesis on how nation states use everyday sounds and everyday like interactions to advance their agenda of nation state building.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good idea. So, you know, if there's a student out there who needs a topic, there you go. You can look at how sound is used to foster and maintain national identity. So if you have a sound that you'd like to submit, go to the contact page at the Eurasian Knot website at euranot.org/contact and submit your sound. And basically what you want is something like, you know, no more than 30 seconds. You can record it. You can send us a link and we'll take care of it and get the recording. And tell us what it means to you. Why did you pick this sound? What does it make you think of when you hear it? And I think speaking of national identity, this week's interview has to do with something that's really critical, I think, to American society. And that is Sesame Street, but the production of Sesame Street in Russia in the 1990s. Have you ever seen Sesame Street in Russia?
Yeah. Growing up as a kid, I remember seeing Sesame Street. It wasn't like part of my daily or weekly TV routine, but right. I definitely remember seeing it a few times. That blue monster, I don't remember what his name is.
Cookie Monster?
Not the Cookie Monster, but the Russian version.
Oh, the Russian version, of course.
The blue guy who was kind of, as I learned while interviewing Natasha, was based on like Russian folklore and like a collective character that was based on various Russian folklore characters.
I should have mentioned that this is an interview with Natasha Lance Rogov about her book, Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia. Forgot to mention that. So would you like to introduce her?
Yes. Natasha Lance Rogov is an award-winning television producer, filmmaker, and journalist who has produced and directed news and documentaries for NBC, ABC, and PBS. She was the executive producer and director of Sesame Street in Russia, Ulitsa Sezam, and the producer of Sesame Street in Mexico, Plaza Sesamo, from 1993 through 1996. She is also the author of the best-selling book, Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia, published by Roman and Littlefield. If you order Muppets in Moscow directly from the publisher, you can get 30% off with the promo code RLFANDF30. Again, it is RLFANDF30. So here's Natasha Lance Rogov.
So Natasha, it's very nice to talk to you, especially about this interesting book / memoir, really, Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia. And why did you write this book and why now? Because this experience of yours happened about 30 years ago, more or less.
Yeah, well, I had wanted to write this book since the Sesame Street show came out, was broadcast. I guess it was now almost 30 years ago. And I saved all the boxes of the journals, videotapes that were shot from that period of time, all the memos and communications that I had with people and letters to my boyfriend at the time. And I just kept moving these boxes around from one house to the other as children were born. And my husband was not happy because the boxes were taking up half a room. And then when COVID hit, I was not able to film anything. And I really desperately wanted to tell the story of the people that I had worked with. And part of this is that this is watching from a period in the 1990s when Russia opened up after the darkness of 70 years of communism. And we were able to work together with Russians, Ukrainians, Armenians, Georgians, and create this magnificently creative, beautiful, lyrical show, which went on to become a huge hit and lasted for more than a decade into Putin's era. And the show educated tens of millions of children across 11 time zones. So when I was thinking about it, I thought, you know, we're watching relations between Russia and the West deteriorate. And then you had the invasion of Crimea. And what I was noticing as I was watching tons of Netflix and Amazon shows during COVID, as everybody else was, is that nearly every Russian character was an oligarch, a criminal, a prostitute, mafia. I mean, it was just, I thought, you know, a spy. Yes. I mean, it just didn't ring true to the incredibly passionate, hopeful people who were making so many sacrifices to live in a future free Russia, to give something better to their children. And I thought this kind of caricature of the Russian people and the country was really dangerous. So I felt that this story, that if there was a way to talk about the Russian people, the culture, the history through the Muppets and all of the cultural challenges and clashes that we had together, that people would be able to have a deeper, more realistic understanding of what the country was like, what the people had gone through, how difficult it was. And in the book, you see the theme of sadness comes up over and over again and impacts almost every aspect of the creative process of the show. So that was really a major reason why I wanted to and as well as you were seeing independent media being attacked at the time. Echo Moscow was being shut down, Rain, all of this was happening. And I felt like these voices are not being heard. This is a story that needs to be heard.
Yeah, definitely. Seeing Russians being turned into caricatures is very painful, like for someone like me, for a Russian person living in the States. And to your comment about the spies, I often get accused of being a spy both in Russia and in the States, which is really crazy to me. What I was curious about is, like, going back to the 90s, how did this idea of bringing the Sesame Street to Russia come about?
Well, Ruslana, if they think you're a spy in both countries, it makes your life way more glamorous than it actually is with an 18-month-year-old, I imagine. The process of creating Sesame Street was utterly amazing because the Sesame Workshop, it's a nonprofit, and they had international co-productions in many countries already for 20 years, but really not in countries that were as unstable and transitional as Russia at that time. And at this moment, just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a sense in the West of real euphoria. You know, here now, for the first time, is this chance for Russia to join the free world. We were, I would say, like excited little kids without realizing the challenges that realistically it was going to present, as well as the time it was going to take for such a huge country that occupies 1/7 of the world's surface to transition. And as an anthropologist, you probably think about this too. You know, what does it take for the change in consciousness and moving from a communist and command economy to a more open society? That's a big leap. It's going to take a lot of time and communication and investment. But at the time, then Senator Biden was working with Sesame Workshop, and he spearheaded congressional support, bipartisan support, for an original Russian version of Sesame Street. That means with new Slavic-inspired Muppets and a new neighborhood. And that was the idea, that the Muppets would model idealistic values of tolerance, compassion, and peaceful coexistence for tens of millions of children across the former USSR, and also give them the skills they would need to thrive in this new open society.
Mm-hmm. When I first heard about your book, I was a bit surprised because the Soviet Union has a really long, rich tradition of really high quality children's programming. I mean, so much so that it continues to resonate today. And I even have Russian friends who are parents in the United States who only allow their children to watch old Soviet children's programming. So I'm curious, like, how did you and your team, on the one hand, see that tradition, understand it, and then what were you bringing to it? Were you adding to it? Were you providing a corrective in your estimation? What was the relationship with that tradition?
It's a great question. Definitely not providing a corrective. That would be such an arrogant opinion, and totally not the Sesame Street way. So what's really unique about Sesame Street is that every international co-production is developed in collaboration with the local artists, the community of producers and media experts, as well as education experts, children's education experts. And the show itself is meant to reflect the local values, culture, and aesthetics of that particular country. So when I was tagged to lead this production, I was extremely excited about working with a lot of the marginalized independent artists who had been persecuted under communism, many of the underground rock musicians, writers, people who were doing animation, but their type of animation wasn't acceptable to the communist state at the time. So for me as an independent filmmaker, you know, in my 30s, early 30s, that was very exciting. The prospect that we together could build this indie team to create a new television show for Russia and the new independent countries like Ukraine and Georgia and all the others. And I was very much aware, having already lived in the Soviet Union from age 22 as an American exchange student for 10 years already. So I spoke Russian, and of course I was familiar with the brilliant tradition of puppetry, which was Sergei Obrazov. The puppeteer is considered the father of puppetry by many, including Jim Henson himself. He wrote about this and he spoke about this. And Jim had visited Russia with his daughter, Cheryl, who worked on this production. So we were all enmeshed in the traditions of Russian children's puppet theater. And it was the same with trying to take into consideration the use of classical music in Russian animation. Russian animation, Cheburashka, is one of the children's animated series that most Russian children were exposed to. And it's utterly brilliant, lyrical, and it's different. It's very different from Disney-style animation. And I write about that in the book as well. But when I first got there, I didn't expect to get the response I did to the Muppets themselves. And I showed my creative team in Moscow the American Muppets like Elmo, Bert and Ernie, and Big Bird. And this was a videotapes of the Muppets. And they just looked at them and they said, those are not going to work in our country. They look too different from our own traditional Russian puppets. And Russian children will never accept them. They'll never bond with those Muppets. And then the head writer told me, you know, Natasha, we have a puppetry tradition that is very revered and dates back to the 16th century. So we'd like to make our Sesame Street, but with our own Russian puppets. And of course, that was really complicated because Sesame Street is a brand. And, you know, what is Sesame Street if it's not with the Muppets? And as far as the music, the head writer, who was an accomplished pianist and composer, Katya, she also said all the music must be classical. And I understood where she was coming from, because most Russian animated films and children's programs use classical music. They didn't use contemporary music. But this also really, really worried me, because a signature feature of Sesame Street is this original, innovative, diverse music. And I had hoped that creating a new show for New Russia would incorporate new sounds, as well as the sounds of all of these marginalized artists, so that it could reflect what the country was going to become in the future.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious why people were married to the idea of classical music and like tradition, and were not as open to like innovations in terms of sound and image.
Yeah, that's kind of funny for me to hear from you, because you're very young. And of course, you know, when we were trying to introduce the new program and then adapt it to reflect the culture, you know, Russia at that time in the 1990s, it was a very different country from today. And it was also different from the Soviet period as well. But people were still quite conservatives. It takes time for people to change. And so they felt their opinions, and I understood where they were coming from. I mean, the opinion of my colleagues was that children were going through a really tumultuous time and that they needed things that were familiar. It was already hard enough. You had food shortages. You had the ruble devaluating by 25% every month, practically. You had a medical system that was collapsing and incredible political instability. At that moment, nobody knew if democracy, even in its fledgling state, was going to hold, or would the country revert back to communism. So it was a very precarious situation. And at the same time, there was a great deal of violence during this time we were operating. So when you're talking about introducing even more changes, like bringing in people who are not part of the establishment, people who were part of the establishment in the media industry were suspicious and hesitant, just as they were suspicious and hesitant of this American team coming in with new ideas of individualism in some ways, the idea that you could express yourself freely. All of these concepts had to take into account where people were coming from and the focus that was given to the collective. And, you know, that things are not about your own personal happiness, they're about the collective happiness. And many of these concepts became really relevant in the writing of the scripts, the design of the Muppet characters, the design of the set. It was so fascinating on so many levels, which is why, as the book's been out now for more than a year, and I hear from so many people, and the thing that makes me feel extremely proud is to hear from Russians and Georgians and other people who say they felt that it was an accurate reflection of their country and of the people, that it was, they could see themselves in it, people say. And for me, that's incredibly satisfying because you always try as a writer so much to feel that you're being honest, not imposing your point of view. You still speak about what you think, but you're also trying to reflect exactly what you are seeing and feeling and what other people are feeling.
I want to ask a question about the diversity, because you spoke about the diversity, of course, of these people who had been marginalized in the Soviet system, the diversity of music. And of course, the other diversity is, you know, Sesame Street has a very proud tradition of showing diversity of people, right? United States, it's famous for showing America as, at least try to show America as it is, this multicultural, multiracial society. And as we know, the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, is also a multi-ethnic society. And especially since you also spoke about ideas of tolerance. Did Sesame Street in Russia address issues of ethnic diversity, tolerance between different groups of people? And how was that managed if it did?
Yes, I mean, the former Soviet Union was an incredibly diverse country with over 200 nationalities, or what you call ethnicities, and many different languages. So it was very challenging to figure out how could you make a TV show that was going to be broadcast to all of these former Soviet territories and republics, and for people to identify with the show and the characters and the setting. So there were many aspects where we had to take that into consideration. And where it came up very first of all was at the curriculum seminar, which is a three-day workshop where the creative team comes together with education experts, teachers, children's health experts, and physicists. And we discuss what it is that the group would like the show to teach their children. What are going to be the educational goals? And the issue of nationalities was much debated, particularly because during the curriculum seminar, it was the same period when Chechen rebels took a group of Russians hostage in Budenovsk. And it was a very tense discussions, because here we are talking about how do you teach preschoolers about a tolerance and conflict resolution with different nationalities, and this is going on. So you're asking people to release their anger and try to be at the table talking about peaceful coexistence while Russians are being killed. So the person who really made this workshop successful and was able to bring the group around to have the discussion was Dr. Anna Genina, who was the head research director for the Russian team, Russian Ulitsa Sazam, which means Sesame Street in Russian. And she was quite amazing, just an amazing diplomat. The group ended up talking about how are we going to incorporate these elements from the different countries. Well, it wasn't possible to do it with language because there were so many different languages. And at this point, the Russian TV station was still broadcasting in Russian across the 11 time zones. And the state of the local television stations was quite primitive at this time. So you really didn't have a well-developed Ukrainian TV operation running that was running in Ukrainian or in Armenian or Georgian. And I find it fascinating that even till 2015, when Zelensky's program came out, Servant of the People, which is a really amazing comedy that foreshadows his becoming the president of the country, that was also in Russian. So that was pretty standard. So the discussion about incorporating language, we knew that wasn't possible. But what the group decided to do was to incorporate a culture from all the different republics, that it would be focused on their art and their music. And that's what the first season, which lasted 2 years, actually did. And we had short films that were shot in the different locations as well, so that people felt that they were seen and respected and a part of this show. And as far as another area of diversity, there was, for instance, the divisions between rural and urban people. That was another theme that came up during the whole set design. And the set designer, Masha Rabasova, she was an absolutely brilliant theater set designer. And this was her first time building a set for television, because we took lots of people from film and television, because the TV industry was also quite primitive at that time, used primarily for propaganda. So I always said to everybody, you know, give it your best shot. Just let's see what you come up with. And she came back empty-handed the first day. And she said, I really don't know what I should be creating. You know, am I creating a set that reflects pre-revolutionary Russia, the Russia of our recent Soviet past, or some future of Russia that I don't even know what it looks like? And we don't know what it looks like yet. And over time, she came up with a really ingenious resolution to this, which is she created a set that combined all the elements of Russia's past. So it included architectural, historical elements of pre-revolutionary Russia, rural Russia, dachas, country houses, Russian Orthodox churches, Stalinist buildings, Khrushchevy, and the Khrushchev cement concrete buildings, and also new featured elements that created more of a neighborhood, so that, as one director who was being kind of facetious said, because you want the Sesame Street set to reflect reality so children can deal with real problems. You know, it's not like you have fairy godmothers solving problems and magic wands and everything. So basically, he said, if you want the set to be real, then you have to have broken glass all over the place, rusty cars, and neighbors reporting on their neighbors to the KGB. So
sunflower seeds and cigarette butts, too, probably.
Yeah, cigarette butts, right. And he was, you know, there were all these kinds of discussions. He was, of course, you know, the whole team was laughing, but there was, you know, some truth in that. So we did not have, obviously, broken glass with our child cast and a rusty car. We created something that was a neighborhood that was truly beautiful and expressed down to the smallest detail of the handcrafted window frames around the windows that were traditional. Is it called nachalniki? I think something like that. Nalichniki, that's it. Nachalniki is the bosses, right? Sorry. Okay, I don't speak Russian that much lately. Anyway, there were also, in the set design, there was a huge discussion about the oak leaf. So there was a giant 40-foot oak tree in the center of the set. And the Masha insisted that it had to be the right oak leaves. They had to be Russian oak leaves, not American ones. You know, one has 6 points, the other has 8 points. I mean, it was down to that level of precision to be realistic, to be reflective of their own country's aesthetics and traditions.
That's really fascinating. I'm not sure if like anyone does that anymore, or, you know, to get into all that nitty gritty. And I'm wondering, like, despite all of the efforts to adapt Sesame Street to the Russian audience, all the way down to the oak leaf shape, still, the program was met with some degree of resistance. You talk about it in your book. Could you tell us a little bit more why people resisted Ulitsa Sezam?
Well, what I write about in the book is that before the show was produced or broadcast, there was opposition to the show, mostly from people who tried to paint it as an imported, imperialistic effort to poison the minds of Russian youth. But honestly, once the show came out and it was a hit from day one, I mean, you're talking about all across the former Soviet Union, it was a huge event. And the fact that the show went on for so long, you know, for more than 10 years, and educated so many of the Russian soldiers you see now in their 30s and 40s who are fighting, and the Russians that are of the same age now. And since the show came out, I've been meeting many people on my book tour in Europe. I've been there 3 times doing talks, and people come up to me, Russians, Georgians, and there's so many Ukrainians there. And these discussions are very moving about how they grew up on Ulitsa Sezam. And how they love, they say, thank you for, you know, making that. And I grew up on that show. I showed the show to my children. So they had videotapes and their children knew about the show. And there really wasn't opposition to the show after it aired. There was literally none. The show is so Russian. I mean, the people that we were working with were really their top artists. Vladimir Volodya Gromadikov is a very famous children's film director. As I say, Masha, theater set designer. We really had the cream of the crop for, the creme de la creme of artistic geniuses working on the show. It was a very lucky team. And they were so passionate and dedicated to creating this vision of Russia as an open society, you know, first on the little screen, and then everybody hoped in reality.
I grew up on Sesame Street, and of course, there are a handful of really iconic characters in the American version: Big Bird, Ernie and Bert, Cookie Monster, The Count, et cetera, et cetera. And you said that, you know, you didn't take just the American characters and then transpose them on a Russian context. You created Russian characters. What were the equivalent Russian characters, right? Because each one of these kind of American characters represents something in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the main characters that were developed in the Russian version?
Yeah, the most exquisite character in Ulitsa Sezam is Zeliboba. And his genesis is a fascinating story about change, really. And I'll sort of tell you briefly what happened is that, you know, as I said in the beginning, that our team didn't want to include the Muppets. And that went on for several months. I called it the Muppet stalemate. And they brought in their top puppet maker at that time, Kolya Komov. And he walked into the office with these 2 sacks and pulled out of each one a puppet. They were wooden marionette style puppets. And then he started performing with them. And he had one of the puppets pick up a stick and start hitting the other puppet. It was like, you know, Punch and Judy style. And the whole team is laughing. And all I can think about is, I really don't know if this Muppet on Muppet violence is going to fly with Sesame Street. But what happened is that the team came to America for a training trip. And they were still very skeptical, but they were meeting Marty Robinson, who performed Snuffleupagus, and Kevin Clash, who was performing Elmo then. And they went to the set. And I don't think they quite understood how big Sesame Street was in America. And they still didn't get it. Like when they're talking to the puppeteers, they're still very like, oh, this is interesting, but we're Russian. This is better, you know. So, but then I took them down to McSorley's to have their first Irish lager in New York City. And when we get out of the subway, there's a group of Black teenagers who start screaming at the group that I'm with. And most of them don't speak English. They speak only Russian. So they're not sure what's going on. And I don't think many of them had ever had many encounters with people who were Black. And so they were a little nervous. And then I realized that they're shouting about Bert and Ernie, my bomber jacket, where Bert and Ernie are embossed on the back. And they come up and they go, "Bert and Ernie, my main man." And then they're like talking about their favorite episodes of Bert and Ernie. And I'm translating for the Russian team, and they cannot believe that these average Americans know what the show is. And like a light bulb goes off in their head, and they realize, wow, you know, this show, wow, imagine if we could have the same impact with our show in our own country. And when they go back to Moscow for the first time, they're willing to do drawings of possible Muppets inspired by their own folklore. So the first design they come up with is based on a character called Domovoy, who is the spirit of the hearth and the home. And I'm thinking, wow, this sounds great. It sounds very poetic, very Russian. And then they start showing me pictures of him. And he's like this hunchback old man with beady eyes and really terrifying looking. And then the drawing they produce kind of looks like that. And I say, okay. And I bring it back to Henson Productions, to Ed Christie, who was this incredibly, I'd say he's a very funny guy, but he's also really a genius at design of the Muppets themselves. And then he oversees all the building. And he just looks at me with pity and says, "These are terrible." So he says, "Look, Natasha, you got to go back. You know, the idea is that the Muppet should be really playful and childlike, and children must be able to identify with the character." So I know. And I knew this anyway. I felt, you know, okay. But I'm also trying to be respectful, follow the process and everything. Now I'm new at this because I hadn't made a children's television show before. So I go back and I talk to them, and they really get it. They say, yeah, you know, and then they come up with this design, which was ingenious. They created Zelyboba, who is a full-size body puppet, taller than Big Bird, and he's made out of blue organza and fur. And he looks kind of like a hound, sort of like a large dog, but he's standing. And he's incredibly playful and nurturing and silly. And to reflect his being like Domovoy and at one with nature, they have asked that he has pieces of twigs and leaves and moss all sewn into his coat. And then the idea is that he will live inside the 40-foot oak tree. So that was this transformation from not wanting the Muppets at all to creating the most exquisite Muppet that has ever been built. And Ed Christie, who builds the Muppets, agrees with me. At some point, he said, "You know, Natasha, what's amazing about working with the Russian team is that, in making this particular Muppet, is that everybody knows what a frog looks like. Everybody knows what a bird looks like, but nobody knows what a tree spirit looks like."
So earlier you spoke a little bit about this research-based approach to children's programming. Could you tell us a little bit more how this process was organized in Russia? And maybe there was something specific to Russia in comparison to the way it was done in the States.
Yeah, the research testing of the content as you're developing it is an intrinsic part of every Sesame Street piece of content. And it involves children's education experts. This is the motif of Sesame Street that's quite unique. And it's now been adopted by, I'd say, nearly all children's television shows, you know, today, where they have to think about what is the educational goal of the show. If you're labeling your show as educational, then you have to, in some way, substantiate it and have quantitative metrics for showing what it does teach to children. So Sesame Street, they were the originators of this idea, really. And in the case of Russia, Dr. Genena, who was the director of research, she was testing the content that we in the creative team were producing, because we were producing hundreds and hundreds of segments that had to be tested for 52 half-hour shows. And the process typically is where a group of children are in a room and they show the content, and then they evaluate eyes on screen to assess attention. And then they do additional one-on-one interviews where they evaluate what has been learned, as well as seeing if the child can, in the case of a letter, like recognize the letter, write the letter, know how the letter is used. So initially we did this type of testing in Russia, and very quickly Dr. Genena noticed that the children, when they were watching the segments, would just sit with their back straight up and expressionless watching the content and their hands folded in their laps. And she said, I think historically, you know, under communism, we've told children to be obedient, listen to adults. And there was an element of fear in the education too, because of repercussions that could happen. You're talking about a society that lived through, you know, Stalinism and the role of propaganda in education that we're now revisiting again in Russia under Putin. But at this time, she said, I think it would be better if there were no adults in the room. And is there a way for us to set up the camera and then we announce all the adults are leaving now and the camera keeps running? So we did that. And the results were staggering. The children started laughing and poking each other and watching the show and reacting to the show once the adults were gone. That wasn't a problem in the U.S. The adults could be in the room and the kids would still react the same way. So we made that adjustment based on Dr. Genena's assessment, which greatly impacted the results that we got.
Wow. And finally, I want to go back to the beginning where we started, and you said you had like all of these boxes and papers and things you've kept from this time of your life. And what was it like going through that material after so long? And is there one moment or memory that sticks with you and will stick with you as you move forward in life?
Well, it was a very, I'd say, bittersweet experience writing this book. Because I have so many, not only memories, but I have friendships that continued now for 30 years. And fortunately, I'm able to speak with many of my former colleagues and friends on WhatsApp. It's incredible to have the internet now compared to the earlier period when, you know, we didn't have it. And basically, there's a sense of incredible loss of this moment of opening and hope for an entire nation of people. And I think I just wanted through the stories to return to that time again, and then also allow that storytelling to shed light on what is happening today, and for people to know that there are so many Russians who can't speak out against the war or protest. You know, they're taking care of small children. They're taking care of elder parents. A normal country doesn't put people in prison for laying down a flower to express their grief of a leader like Navalny's death. So I think about that now. But, you know, when I was going through all the materials, it just made me so proud of what we did, what we accomplished together with such a diverse team and all the challenges that we came up. And it was a process of learning about each other in order to be successful. Otherwise, we would have failed. And I also was feeling that it was really important as our two countries were becoming more and more isolated from each other. We were becoming more isolated than at any point during the height of the Cold War. So it just felt so dangerous, like we were veering into a period that potentially could lead to nuclear war. So I felt like it was really important to write this. And then personally, it gave me a chance to reconnect with many people who I hadn't spoken to, my former colleagues. You know, I was on the phone with them or I was Zooming with them before Zoom was canceled. And it felt like I had just talked to them yesterday. I mean, we just picked up where we left off because we were a family making this show together. We went through incredible challenges of our partners getting assassinated, our sponsors getting blown up in car bombs, the office getting taken over by soldiers with AK-47s. All of this happened to all of us together. And yet I was constantly aware that I, as an American, could always leave.
That was Natasha Lenz Rogoff. Natasha Lenz Rogoff is an award-winning television producer, filmmaker, and journalist who has produced and directed news and documentaries for NBC, ABC, and PBS. She was the executive producer and director of Sesame Street in Russia, Улица Сезам, and the producer of Sesame Street in Mexico, Plaza Sésamo, from 1993 to 1996. She's also the author of the best-selling book, Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia, published by Roman and Littlefield. If you order Muppets in Moscow directly from the publisher, you can get 30% off with the promo code RLFANDF30. It's RLFANDF30.
Thanks a lot for that, Rusana. That is quite a mouthful, that promo code. So people should take advantage of that to get 30% off this book. And as you might know, my name is Sean Guillory and I'm the host.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
And this episode, as with all of our episodes, was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper from Podcuts Editing. If you need some audio help, go to Daniel, take advantage of his services, and he will give you your first edit for free. So go to podcutsediting.com and check him out. The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh and listeners just like you. If you want to help out, it's really important if you can share the episodes, tell your friends, let people know about it, or more importantly, become a patron. That's a big help to us. So that's it for this week. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye. Потом ее чтрезим, чтоб не убежал.